This is episode number 9, Doctors Diagnose, Nurses Heal, and Caregivers Make Sense of It All.
Welcome to the Innovateology Podcast, where it is all about unleashing the creative side to find those brilliant, disruptive ideas to validate and build innovative solutions to solve life's problems.
Hello and welcome. This is your host, Mary. Today we will be speaking with Linda and Melissa on their perspective of caregiving with elderly parents. Okay, even if you're not caring for elderly parents yet, I think this is an eye-opening episode and will give some thoughts into helping plan ahead. And I like that Melissa and Linda share their experiences and give some very helpful tips. So, Linda and Melissa, take it away with the aging parents. I know I'm going to have some questions for you.
Okay. Melissa?
So, Linda and I both have elderly parents, which we're primarily responsible for. And like Mary said, the burden usually falls on the women of the family, which is both in our cases. And the burden is can be financial or can be mental and it can be physical on the caregiver. So first I'll go through just some quick stats on financial burden for women. In one study, they found that 33% of working women decreased their worked hours, 30% passed up a job promotion, 21.2% took a leave of absence, 20% had to switch from full-time to part-time, 16% quit their jobs, and 13% retired early. But the big thing is, you know, that loss of job and financial security actually impact each of the individual female caregivers, $324,000 in lost wages and Social Security benefits, which is
wow.
Huge. Then there's the mental burden. You know, there's just higher levels of depression, anxiety, and challenges. One study found that women who provided care for ill or disabled spouse were 6 times likely to suffer depression or anxious symptoms compared to those who don't have any caregiver responsibilities. And then there's the loss of, because it takes so much time, there's the loss of social, it's kind of like social isolation because, you know, you just don't have the time and it really can affect your well-being. And then there's the physical burden. So that's even, this is kind of shocking, is that women caregivers are less likely to take care of their own healthcare needs. But they do the same thing with children too, right?
No, it's so true. Everything you're saying right now, like I think even is very true right. For women, because I remember giving birth to the first child and it's kind of like you go in isolation because your life changes on your whole entire schedule of what you have to do to care for that infant, from feeding to nightly routines and not sleeping. And you kind of forget to take care of yourself. You forget to say, okay, I'm actually a human in this. I've just been wrapped up with this particular project. So it makes total sense.
Yeah. And moms have to give up jobs too. They do. You know what I mean? Or a different job or promotion or whatever also. Then there's the, you know, on this physical burden, they showed that coronary heart disease is the one physical risk factor of caregiving, which I never heard of, which is coronary heart disease is basically having heart attack or stroke. Women who spend 9 or more hours caring for an ill or disabled spouse increase their cardiovascular risk twofold. Wow. And then they also get more hypertension, poor health status, poor immune function, and actually an increased risk of mortality. So those are all kind of negative things, but they're, you know, the one study they showed that, you know, that it can be rewarding, that they feel a gain of a purpose in life, and they have a better, you know, feeling of purpose in life than non-caregiving women. So, you know, going with that in mind, I'm just going to tell my story really quick on my situation. And I had two elderly parents in their late 80s who were doing great, living at home, you know, really, really healthy for their age, was still doing outside work and everything. You know, we had tried to get them to downsize. They had the 5-bedroom house still, but they didn't do it. Then all of a sudden, my father got really, really sick with a serious, rare, very rare spine infection. And he was rushed to the hospital, given an emergency surgery on his back, and he ended up in the hospital for 5 months. Now, this could have happened to anybody, because actually it's not just of the elderly, but that's what he got. So, you know, I've been through 5 months of being at the hospital every day, in and out of 5 to 6 rehab nursing homes, because he kept going in back and forth. Then he was in long-term care. And all this time my mom was living with me, and she had some issues on her own. And then now finally, it's been about a year and a couple months that he's improved to the point where they're both living together in assisted living. So, you know, I learned a lot. I wish I knew before that started. I just didn't have any friends who had this, you know, much issue with their parents. So there's a lot to learn about Medicare Part A, Part B, what, you know, how do you get into a rehab? How do you get out? How many days you have? Why they can kick you out? You know, it's, what's the difference between long-term care, assisted living? What kind of care you get? What kind of care you don't? And I'm still learning on the way, you know, but, I really just had to face things as they came up and figured it out. So it was really just like a whirlwind of issues, one after another. So you really, you have to find it out. You got to fight for it. Even fighting for physical therapy for your elderly parent or seeing the right doctor. Because after going through this whole experience, I truly believe if someone's not watching your loved one or parent, I can see how elderly parents or people, you know, in hospitals, assisted living or nursing, die quicker or languish because they don't have somebody getting them through this whole thing. You know, but I suggest to someone who hasn't gone through it, or, you know, if you have elderly parents right now, read up on it, because, you know, like I said, it hit me like a brick. I had no, absolutely no clue this was going to, you know, this soul was going to go like it did. So here's my tips. And these are more, you know, practical as far as like negotiating through Medicare and the hospital. So if your elderly parent doesn't stay in the hospital, for they're not going to get into rehab or qualify. So whether they're in the hospital that first time, whether it's 2 days, 2 nights, or 3 nights, makes a huge, huge difference. And nobody really tells you that. Luckily, my father was 3 nights over 3 nights. And then, you know, every time they decided, well, you know, he's going to leave the hospital now, they tell me that night, and they're like the social worker, or it's on the weekend, she hasn't contacted me, and, you know, I didn't even know where he was going to go. I hadn't looked at places to look at, you know, I had no idea, you know, where rehabs were or what they were like or anything. And so I had to fight for him to stay longer in the hospital so I could figure out, you know, where to put him. So, you know, so the suggestion there is you find the social worker right away as soon as you get into the hospital. And you find that person because they're supposed to be helping you through this. And most of the time he was in and out of the hospital 5 times. And each time, you know, they never found me. I had to run out and get them. But anyway. Then you only get 90 days for Medicare Part A for hospitalization before you start paying it for it. And luckily, my father was exactly 89 days in the hospital, so I didn't have to deal with that. But wow. Then once you go from the hospital, he went into rehab, you know, to start walking again and everything. And that's still Part A, and you get 100 days. So you think, oh, another 100 days of Part A, you know what I mean? And where, you know, you're not paying, they're paying for it. But basically, there's a catch 22. And what it is that if your parent starts getting better, they're going to say, oh, they're better enough to, you know, they don't need rehab anymore. But if they don't get better, they say to you the opposite. Well, they don't get better, so they can't have rehab anymore. So basically, I can see where Medicare has it that majority of patients do not go 100 days, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so my father was so ill that, you know, he was on a tube. He was, you know, on a feeding tube and everything. So in the end, he did start to improve and walk a little bit. So he kept on and got the 100 days. Then after the 100 days, we went into long-term care nursing home and we had to pay for it ourselves. And that's, you know, like $12,000 a month. So it's huge difference from childcare, you know. And then he got better and we got him to assisted living with my mom, which is half the price, so which is, you know, better financially. But then there's all the issue of his medical care. Now I have a background in healthcare, so I was able to really focus on his medical issues and I could research them and I could talk to the doctor on their level. But you know, they don't always look, and you can always look back and say, I made a mistake, but the only big mistake I can see that I made, you know, looking back over that frantic 7 or 8 months was that I didn't get him a pain specialist sooner. And, you know, I relied on the internists and everybody to give him pain medications. But after we saw a pain specialist the last time we were in the doctor, it made a huge, huge difference. So, you know, and also, you know, the specialist kept saying to me, oh, your father's, you know, going to die. They wanted to put him in hospice. Well, he didn't. It's a miracle. And he's still alive, thank God. So just big picture, I'd say, wrapping up, it's, you know, it's a definite burden on caretakers, you know, myself and my mom. And, you know, it has affected my life, just what I talked about, financially, less income, socially, less social time, less personal time, medical, you know, I've had emotional ups and downs where I couldn't sleep, knowing he was so sick and in so much pain. And, you know, I've gone to the doctor less myself and now have medical issues. So, but, you know, like there is a reward in the sense that your parents are better off for it. They took care of you. You were taking care of them. And mine are doing better now. So, you know, I know I won't regret it. So
it's, and what's powerful in your situation, Melissa, that I find is that you were able to use your knowledge to make an impact in your parents' life. Yeah. So that to me is the most powerful part that I find, that by using our knowledge and using what we have learned from our experiences, we're able to make that impact in their lives to offer them better care. I think we sometimes take that for granted. And I know Linda also maybe has a similar story of kind of how, you know, using your knowledge has helped in that situation. I know the same goes when I was in the hospital giving birth both times. Being able to kind of find that group of advisors, I called it the birth team, where they were people that weren't at the hospital, but were maybe aunts who were nurses or uncles who were in the ER that understood maybe a different point of view or had a different opinion that I could make as kind of my healthcare advisor team, where if I was experiencing something, I could quickly call them or ask for a second opinion, ask for that third opinion. What do you think's going on? What should I be asking? Because as it's happening, it's like basically a freight train is coming and it's going to hit you and you got to know how to react. And I think that that's one of the best lessons that I learned was kind of figuring out who's going to be on that healthcare team advisors and help coach you through that moment. And it's not easy because sometimes you're doing the late night Wikipedia internet search for what does this mean? And a lot of times just having that conversation and knowing how to have that conversation is probably one of the most difficult parts of going through that experience.
Right. And personal drive. I know you have to have personal drive to get through it. You have to push and push. And I know, you know, Mary, you have personal drive. I know Linda has it too. You have to have that, you know, real push. Mm-hmm. It just comes from within that you're going to figure it out and you're going to get it done.
So yeah. An example I like to use is I say, if you were to buy a car, would you get an opinion? Or if you were to buy something that was a lot of money, would you get an opinion? And most people would say, yes, I'd get an opinion if I was going to go buy a house. I'd get someone to look at it for me. I would inspect it. I'd get a second person to look at it and inspect it for me. That's the same that I say for healthcare. Don't just rely on one opinion. Get as many people as possible because it's your health. You got to know what's going on. And it's your parents' health, right? So you've got to even be looking out for them and saying and helping them because they may not be in the best frame of mind to make those decisions like they had made for us. And so that's why I say it's get that second, get that third, get that fourth opinion, and don't be afraid to keep asking. I think the biggest pitfall I've learned in life is just not asking enough questions. You can never ask enough questions.
Yeah. Definitely.
So Linda, share your situation. Yes. We're curious to hear.
Sure. Well, actually, Mary, as you and Melissa have alluded to, there's a lot of common features between caregiving, regardless of the age of the person, whether it's a child or a parent. I'll start with some specifics of my situation. I became a caregiver with the sudden death of my father. It left my mother without her spouse of 60 years. And when you consider he had been part of her life since she was only 19 years old, not having him was a loss with depths I can't imagine. So in the first 4 months following the death of my dad, I stayed with my mom because it was just incomprehensible for me how she could navigate grieving and not have that companionship. So I became her companion. And unfortunately, 1 month after my dad passed away, test results showed that my mother had recurrent cancer. So that was kind of startling to learn. And then 4 months after he left us, my mother had two falls within a week of each other. First, she broke her hip, and then she broke her leg. All of this was a sort of roller coaster for my family and I, trying to grapple with just the loss of my father and then all the life changes for my mother. In the 2 years preceding these events, I had set up a consulting business and had fleshed out what were my goals for my starting business. And I felt pretty good about myself and what I was able to achieve with it, and was looking forward to continuing along that track. However, my mother's care needs accrued to the point where I had to give myself a family medical leave from my business and really focus on her. And I prefer to say became my mother's life manager as opposed to just caregiver, because really, and I think this is the case with children and what Melissa described, Dan, Mary described, that you're managing much more than just matters of health for an individual. So, and no matter how large the family is, as the statistics show, typically the weight of caregiving falls to one person, and that's usually a female in the family. Now, this has its own pros and cons. The biggest pro I have found is that when I finally stopped wishing, asking, and pleading with other people in the family for help or even recognition, on occasion for what I took on and even what I gave up, once I stopped that, I actually started to mentally accept myself as the main person in charge. And I started to frame this as I'm a decision maker. And once I kind of freed myself from no longer having the expectation that there would be some form of consensus in decision making, it actually was liberating. Because I felt a greater sense of being in control of my circumstances. Of course, it helps to make sure that you have the legal designation, so you should be a power of attorney. certainly that's helpful to make sure that you don't run into some problems down the road. Now, the biggest con is obvious because you're really a one-man or woman show, and you have to use or create your own support team to help you move away from the temptation to dwell on feeling sorry for yourself. And what I found is I'd fall into feeling sorry for myself, and then I'd feel guilty for feeling sorry for myself because, after all, my mother really had given up so much in her life to care for me. So it can be kind of a challenging circumstance just mentally.
Linda, I have a question for you. So I know that you have many brothers and sisters, and how do you gain alignment? So what I mean by that is sometimes when you're trying to decide for care and decision makings, and when the weight's kind of falling on you and you got to make a decision on what to do, how do you quickly gain their alignment? Do they let you kind of run the show because they trust you, or is there some trust issues where they're like, you know, I want to get a second opinion? How do you handle that?
Well, it's definitely challenging, Mary, and it's a great question because oftentimes the other siblings can have a lot of opinions and they aren't really riding things as closely as you may. What was reinforcing to me was actually when I was meeting with one of my mother's doctors, and he actually volunteered that when he was the primary caregiver for one of his parents, that he ran across the challenges of siblings weighing in very heavily and even being critical of his decision making. But he kind of was the person close to it. So to go back to my case, what ended up happening really was I did experience what the doctor shared, but my siblings ended up defaulting just because they really didn't have the time to be as engaged as I was. And so, you know, we'd have a lot of discussion. And then I think actually being in business for our lives, you know, we've spent all of us so much time in business, and we know how to put together business cases and arguments for, you know, why circumstances or certain why decisions should go a certain way. So I think I just built on a lot of the skills I had from my business life to kind of build a case to support the decisions that I was advocating.
And it sounds like you have the experience of also incorporate gaining cross-function approval and alignment, as they say, in corporate world.
And actually, Mary, as you mentioned, a sort of evolving role with caregiving for children, I found that there are similarly kind of this curve that happens when you're caring for a parent, but it's probably, you know, the inverse, because you're seeing caregiving with a child where the child becomes more and more independent. And by contrast, Melissa and I see circumstances where there's improvements perhaps and some independence, but their kind of trajectory is more downward than kind of in a more upward position.
So it's almost like the Benjamin Button movie where, you know, we see the caregiving at both stages of life, but it's completely opposite. But yes, it is nice to see when they can start to eat food on their own and you don't have to hold a bottle in front of their face. But when they're going downhill, you had to keep holding it until whenever that time does come.
Yeah, so it can be challenging, and even seeing, you know, accepting the fact that you're not going to continually see improvements is even another mental hurdle to get past. But, you know, in the first 4 months when I was with my mom, she actually was mobile. She was living in her house. She was driving just locally and making some of her meals. So she was, you know, relatively independent from, you know, physical way. She had some issues of, you know, she showed some onset of dementia even while my dad was around. And I know it was a huge cause of stress for him. So there was certainly that. And actually, you know, when you're with somebody who is in a grief state, sometimes it's really hard to discern the difference between the forgetfulness and confusion that may be grief related versus what is actually, you know, age related. So I had some of those challenges of, you know, I gave my mother a lot of leeway for, you know, considering a lot of behaviors as related to the grieving process. And as part of that, I ended up addressing all of the matters of transition that followed the death in our family. And as prepared as my parents were and as organized as they were, I would advise people to be prepared that there's still going to be a lot of challenges along the way, because I found that the matters I had to address were much broader in scope than I would have anticipated and more challenging than I could have expected. And I'd say a lot of the challenges, too, when you're handling something like that, become emotional ones as well, because my father had a lot of devices, and it's really hard to disconnect service for those devices. And I'd say even a year later, I still haven't done that. So you have to give yourself allowances for things like that. But regardless, I took on more and more of an active role of really managing financials for my mother and then participating fully in her healthcare. So following her fall, she went into rehab and spent a month there. And she progressed really well with her physical healing, but it became pretty clear that she wasn't going to be able to live independently anytime soon. So the choice became, do we do an in-home care situation, or do we transition to assisted care? And so it required investigating both of those options. And again, Mary, it's remarkably similar to the process that you went through. When we looked at in-home care, I'd say the top pros were that your loved one gets to remain in a familiar setting. They get to remain with familiar neighbors. And in theory, at least, there's a greater sense of control, a lesser sense of disruption, and there's greater comfort. The cons come in with really finding those available, committed, compassionate, professional, experienced in-home care persons. Those persons are really challenging to find, and there's a lot of competition for the really, highly regarded persons out there. Because they aren't paid very much, long-term retention is challenging, especially for persons that are perhaps meeting the qualifications that you have set up. And then the dependability of the persons, just as Mary alluded to with, you know, somebody can get sick and somebody can just quit on you, and then you're left with trying to fill that gap. And also there's a difference in consistency of care. While there may be an aide who is really fabulous and very dependable with the scheduled delivery of care, there are some folks who maybe have a lesser attention to details. And then last but not least, you have unfamiliar persons in your home. And that can be disconcerting for the loved one who's being cared for, because they're already in a fragile state. And now they have a cadre of unfamiliar people entering their home. And that can present some safety and security concerns that are very real.
And I face that every day with a nanny as well too, because you don't know this person other than like a couple interviews, and you have to make a decision, because if you find somebody good, like you just mentioned, you have to snatch them really well, really quickly. Mm-hmm. They don't have much time on market. It's almost like when you're, I think we've all done this. We've all been hiring managers at least one point in our life, where you have that good person walk in, they're meeting all that criteria. They have a great background check, references, everything. You literally have like one day to snatch them before that other company does. So that's absolutely the same with professional caregivers, is that you have to snatch them. But the problem is that you don't always have the time to do that thorough reference check when you do that. And so sometimes they can have the stellar, you know, references. You call them, maybe you only got a hold of two out of the five. And this happens even with employers at work, is, you know, trying to really make sure that you got that solid person. But when you don't know that person coming into it and you don't have family references, it does become a bit disconcerting, and we all have to think twice about, you know, that gut instinct that we're all born with. Would you trust that person?
Yeah, absolutely. They're very real concerns and considerations. And the other option that can be considered for an old is a family member with in-home care. Certainly there's occasions when people take a family member into their home. In our case, we had a family member who expressed a willingness to move into my mother's home. So the pros are you have a familiar person who knows the person who's in need of care, and it can be a win-win situation because there's companionship for both parties with someone that they both love. And you also have that nice safety and security factor. The cons are that family members are typically not healthcare professionals. They may have the best of intentions, but they may not be prepared for the real demands of caregiving. Even when you love someone, caregiving can be challenging, and especially as the care needs increase. As I alluded to a minute ago, with an elderly person, there can be a lot of changes and a lot of increases that are required in the intensity of care. And it may be that someone who initially was capable finds themselves at a level of care that they're no longer competent at. And it's certainly not realistic to expect that a family member could.
I know, it looks matter. Like we just lost you for a minute, Linda.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. It's not realistic to expect that a family member could provide 24/7 care. They may need time away and should have time away in order to be really have energy for the caregiving. And it's likely that they'll have an occasional sick day, as Mary's stats and Melissa's stats showed, that oftentimes the caregiver for an elderly person is older themselves. So it's likely that from time to time, they're not going to be feeling well. Therefore, you have to have a backup care. And it becomes very disruptive and stressful to have a sudden care need open up and have to quickly fill that need. And it's also an important point to note that care direction from family may be more easily dismissed or ignored by the person who's being cared for. So, for instance, when a daughter tells a parent that it's time for them to take their medicine or that they need to move in a certain manner to make sure it's a safe manner to transition, let's say, from a walker or a chair. Sometimes a parent can easily become agitated or dismissive when it's their child giving direction. But I have found that a person who is not a family member can be received much more positively by my parent. So let's move on to assisted care. I'll assume here for the baseline that we're talking about an assisted care facility that is already, you know, they have a good reputation and track record. So we'll assume there's a baseline of confidence in just the facility and its management. So the pros for assisted care are that you have 24/7 assisted care provided. Harry said, with daycare for children, it's a big relief to know you have that consistency of oversight. And then you have aides or nurses that visit the room for the care tour person every 2 hours and often more frequently. While the level of care may be variable, the nice thing is that they're within these facilities, as your care needs shift, whether it's up or down, you can make adjustments with the facility, which is really nice to have that flexibility. And then they also pride themselves on being there for the scheduled administration of medicines. And this really makes a huge difference. I've seen my mother go from being very inconsistent when she was self-administering over the years and had quite a bit of edema or swelling in her legs that has absolutely gone away thanks to the proper administration of medicine. Also, as Mary said, when an aide or nurse calls out sick or quits, the facility takes on the responsibility of replacing the person, and that's a huge burden that's removed from you. Some cons are that there are variabilities among the aides and the nurses in terms of their bedside manner and their level of attention to individuals as even human beings and provision of required care. We'll respond to a call button, but it can be delayed. I've actually been really frustrated as a novice to this and even timed them and found that sometimes it's like 15, even 20 minutes before there's a response, which has really bothered me until I stopped to think that if my mother was in her home, that it's quite possible that even if I were the caregiver, I could be in another room or occupied with something where I might not be responding much more quickly than that. So it is difficult if your parent has to use the bathroom and they're waiting 10 minutes for somebody to help them. And there's certainly the risk that if they're waiting, that they may try to do something they shouldn't on their own. But this seems to be just a really unfortunate factor. And what I have found, too, that's scary is that sometimes the aides or nurses will run in the room, turn off the alarm, and run back out without even asking what the care issue is. And this is a circumstance that you really need to flag with the management, because they should at least take the time to find out whether it's an emergency or not before they depart the room to attend to something else. The other thing is that, and perhaps this is a really unfortunate point for many people, but when you put someone in assisted care, you can't just assume that everything is running fine and you can kind of forget about it. There's still the need for an engaged advocate. You have to be there regularly on your toes, following everything to make sure that the proper care is given. So, we have to keep in mind that what we're concerned about is the whole person. So the caregiver really has the holistic view of the loved one, concerned with the care of the mind, body, spirit, well-being. So a suggestion is to help navigate this in a way that's productive and healthy for both persons. I suggest establishing a care team. It's going to be virtual, but it's helpful to think of everyone engaged in the care of your loved one as a team, especially since you're likely to be the only person that has the whole person view of that person. And it's only you who can identify where there's care gaps and then seek to fill those gaps working with your care team. So get to know your doctors, the nurses, and the aides. Get all their contact information readily accessible on your mobile device. And be sure that you have HIPAA documents that are on file with each doctor so you can be the point of access for medical information. And as I mentioned, as the primary caregiver, you should be designated as the healthcare power of attorney, and it should be noted as the person on a durable healthcare power of attorney. My suggestion is for anyone's health and well-being, because let's face it, anyone, again, needs to have time away to re-energize, that you should have more than one person listed on these durable healthcare power of attorneys. The way we are amending ours is to have me as the primary person and then followed by another sibling and then another sibling and then the fourth sibling, so that if any one of us is not available, someone else can step in. Then I recommend to help the care team to help your loved one and you. Care people do really want to perform well, and they really do want to have everyone satisfied with the care that your loved one gets. So tell the appropriate care people when there's a change that concerns you, and really help them to help you. Keep them informed. If there's something that you learned when you went to a doctor visit that will be helpful for them to know, make sure that they know it so that they can address it for your loved one. Ask for help, even request, you know, meetings with a 5-minute call or 10-minute face-to-face meeting is helpful. Then I also suggest that for the person who is the caregiver, you need to establish a support team. In most cases, it will also be virtual, but think of the people who really offer you support and energize your life as your support team. And if you can, to begin this process, I suggest that you kind of consider what really energizes you in your life and perhaps what drains you. And when you consider what energizes you, then think about the people that may participate in that and how they may help to form that support team for you. For me, my spiritual life is important, so I periodically check in with a spiritual director. I participated in a small group at my church for adults who were seeking to grow in their spirituality. I took a class in mindfulness-based stress reduction and began to regularly practice mindfulness, and I periodically attend a mindfulness group. I think that creative outlets are really vital for me, for my health and well-being. So actually, my friendship with Melissa really has been great, because even though we've only had the opportunity to paint together on a couple of occasions, just being able to talk about art and painting with Melissa is just really, really helpful for me. And the whole Innovateology project that we're participating in with these podcasts with Mary and Melissa has really offered me an opportunity to learn and utilize skills that I've developed. So I really value Mary and Melissa as part of my virtual support team. And last but not least, I'd say make room for the unexpected. There's going to be those times in caregiving where something happens that's unplanned. So long as those in your support team know what your priorities are, in the case of me, it's my mother, that they're aware that there are going to be times that something unexpected occurs and I have to change my schedule. So they'll know, they'll be much more receptive to it. Again, help your support team to help you. Ask for support, and then importantly, accept support. And I guess what I would close with is just to say that I think that caregiving today is not our grandmother's caregiving universe. People are living longer with conditions that were formerly life-ending. Levels of care are greater and for longer periods of time. People are living healthier longer, which means the persons who are becoming caregivers are older when they become caregivers when it comes to an aging parent. And when you're in a high-stress situation like this, it can be really difficult to know what to do in order to cope. So my suggestion is to just take a few minutes each day to reflect on what has energized you the most and the least. And try jotting it down for a period of 30 days. You'll be surprised what you learn about yourself, and it will provide you with insights regarding what you should dial up in your life and what you should dial down in order to live a more full life while you're caregiving. And that's kind of my perspective on to date on caregiving for a parent.
Wow, I've learned a lot. I hope our audience has learned a lot. I know we've been talking for quite a while on the differences of caregiving throughout life and learning about what it's like from that beginning stage and what it looks like for that new parent to taking care of that aging parent. And I know we'll have probably more questions on this topic about the sandwich generation that I might have to be experiencing soon. But I think what's nice about this Innovateology platform is that it's a place to share. It's a place to learn. It's a place to bounce those ideas off of, so you're not going through this alone. So thanks again to our audience for listening. And until next time, keep innovating and working on those processes.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for listening to the Innovateology Podcast. We hope we have generated some disruptive ideas and helped unleash that creative side. Please help us keep innovating and leave us a comment or a review on our website. Till next time, don't stop innovating.